I feel like Michael J. Fox in that werewolf movie. Remember when he started growing hair all over? It was like he was turning into Connie. Lula gave up on the teeth and looked over at the house. I'm bringing this dog back because that's the right thing to do, but that Bride of Frankenstein better not start on me. The Bride of Frankenstein likes us now. She said she guessed I wasn't such a bad slut. Bet you got all excited over that. Lula levered herself out of the escape, holding tight to Boo. She set him down on the ground. Boo ran to the Apusenja's front door and started yapping to be let in. Mrs. Apusenja opened the door and let out a shriek. She scooped up Boo and held him close and got a lot of sloppy Boo kisses. "Isn't that nice?" Lula said. "A family reunited. It almost makes me want to get a dog, except for the peeing and pooping part." "Tell me about it." Chapter 15. I was on my way back to the office when Grandma Mazur called.
"We got a situation here," she said. "I don't suppose you're in the neighborhood."
"What kind of a situation?"
"Valerie decided she's going to marry Albert."
"That's great."
"Yeah, except Albert's been living with his mom, and his mom isn't happy that Albert's not marrying in his faith. Albert's mom wants him to marry a Jewish girl, and so she's kicked him out of the house. That means everyone's going to be living here. Albert just showed up with a couple boxes of his stuff, and he's moving it into that little room upstairs with Valerie and the girls."
"Oh, boy."
"Exactly. We need to put rubber walls on this house. We don't all fit in it anymore. Your father says he's moving in with Harry Farnsworth. He's upstairs packing, and your mother's all upset."
"My dad's moving out?"
"I can sort of see his point on this. He had to drive to the gas station on Hamilton to use the bathroom this morning, so I don't exactly blame him. But what's your mother going to do if your father moves out permanent? Where's she going to find another man? It's not like she's a live wire."
I did a large mental sigh. "I'll be right there."
"Don't tell nobody I called you," Grandma said.
I made a U-turn on Hamilton and smiled, knowing Cal was scrambling to follow me in the big explorer. Lula leaned over the seat, watching him.
"Good to keep a man on his toes," Lula said. "I bet he's all worried back there, cursing you out. He can't find a place to wheel that SUV around. Uh-oh, he just jumped the curb and knocked over a garbage can. Ranger won't be happy to see a scratch on that shiny new car."
I pulled into the driveway, blocking my father's car so he couldn't make a getaway. Then I ran back to Cal, who was parking in front of the house. His face was red, and a trickle of sweat traced a path down his temple. "It's okay if you park here," I said to Cal and Junior, "but don't get out of the car. Both of you stay here and try to look normal." Even as I said it, I knew it was an impossible request. "And don't worry about that big gash in the right front fender. It's really not all that bad," I said. The red in Cal's face kicked up a notch. Lula was waiting for me on my parents' front porch.
"You are so evil," she said. "There's no gash in the right front fender."
Grandma Mazur opened the door to me.
"What a surprise," she said real loud. "Look, everyone, Stephanie's here."
Mary Alice was back to being a horse, galloping around the house, making horse sounds. The baby was screaming surprisingly loud for a newborn, and Valerie was furiously rocking it in the rocking chair. Angie was drawing on a pad in the dining room. She had cotton wads stuck in her ears, and she was singing, trying to drown out the noise. Albert Clown was pacing in front of Valerie.
"Maybe there's something wrong with her," Clown said to Valerie. "Maybe we should take her back to the hospital. Maybe she's hungry. Maybe she's wet."
"Maybe she's got gas," Grandma Mazur said. "I know I do. This family's getting on my nerves. I can't stand all this noise and commotion. It gives me indigestion. I gotta get some Maalox."
"I'm out of here," Lula said. "Nice seeing you and all, but I'm gonna wait in the car. I'm not good with crying babies. I've been locked in a truck cab with a dog and two horny truck drivers for the last couple days, and on top of that, I'm worried I'm turning into a carnivore."
"I wouldn't mind hearing about the two horny truck drivers," Grandma said.
I went into the kitchen where my mother was ironing. She always irons when she's upset.
Ordinarily, no one would approach my mother when she's got an iron in her hand, but I thought I should say something. "This house is bedlam," I said to her. "I got a nice almond ring from the bakery," my mother said. "Help yourself, and there's fresh coffee." Even when my mother was in a state, she was still a mother. "What do you think of my hair?" I asked her. She looked at me and made the sign of the cross. "Holy Mary, Mother of God," she said. Then she smiled. "I can always count on you to top anything we have going on here. I hear Val's getting married, thank goodness. And I hear they're all going to live here." "What can I do?" my mother said. "They have to live someplace. Am I going to turn my daughter out on the street? They're going to buy a house as soon as Albert gets a little more established." There were heavy footsteps on the stairs. "Your father," my mother said. "He's moving out. We've been married for over 30 years, and now he's moving out." Only if he pushed my car out of the driveway. I went back to Val in the living room and shouted over the baby. "I'm living with Morelli these days," I said. "Why don't you and the kids and Albert move into my apartment?" This was right up there with poking myself in the eye with a hot stick. I didn't really want to turn my apartment over to Valerie, but it was the only way I could immediately get her out of my parents' house.
"It would just be temporary," Clown said. "Just until we find a place of our own. Boy, that's really nice of you. Valerie, isn't that nice of Stephanie?"
"It is," Valerie said, shifting the baby so it could nurse. Lisa stopped crying, and Valerie looked like she was morphing back to the serene Saint Valerie. I was thinking that there was probably a lot of my mother in Valerie.
"There's nothing like a baby," Grandma said.
Mary Alice galloped by and stopped to look.
"I'd rather have a horse," she said.
"When she gets older, you'll be able to help feed her," Valerie said. "And she'll be as much fun as a horse."
"Horses have nice silky tails," Mary Alice said.
"Maybe we'll let Lisa grow her hair long into a ponytail," Valerie said. "Would you like to take the little cap off her head so you can see her hair?" Mary Alice took the cap off Lisa's head, and we were all transfixed by the wispy dark hair that swirled from Lisa's crown and framed her face. Lisa's tiny hands were balled into fists. Her eyes were open and fixed on Valerie. And just like that, as of that instant, I wanted a baby. I didn't care if it had to come out of my vagina.
"I'll tell your father about the apartment," Clown said. "I don't think he really wanted to move in with Harry Farnsworth."
"I'll go over and box my stuff so you have room in the closet. You can move in any time. Only thing, if there are any flower deliveries, you should be sure to call me right away."
"Thanks," Valerie said. "You're a good sister. I'll make it up to you, and we'll start looking for a place of our own right away."
I yelled goodbye to my mom, and I went out to Lula. Lula was in the car looking antsy.
"I don't know what's wrong with me," Lula said. "I just feel all jumpy. I'm just not myself."
"You're not still worried about your teeth, are you?"
"I know they're growing. I can feel it. It's unnatural. And I got these cravings. I want to bite down on something. I want to feel it crunch in my mouth."
"Geez, you mean like a bone?"
"Like an apple or a cheese doodle. Nothing crunches on this diet. Meat doesn't crunch. I'm crunch deprived."
I was a baton twirler when I was in high school, and that's how I felt now, like I was leading a parade. I pulled away from the curb, and Cal pulled away from the curb. I drove to my apartment building. Cal followed me to my apartment building. We all parked in the lot. We all got out of our cars. We all took the elevator to the second floor. Then everyone followed me down the hall to my apartment. First Lula, then Cal, and then Junior. Junior was a clone of Cal, except for the tattoo. Junior was tattoo-free. At least what I could see of him was tattoo-free, and that was more than enough for me. Cal opened the door to my apartment and took a look inside. Nothing out of the ordinary popped up, so we all trooped in. I filled a laundry basket with clothes and personal stuff, and moved some things around to free up space for Valerie. While I was freeing space, I could hear Lula trying to make conversation with Cal.
"Hey," Lula said. "What's going on?"
"What do you mean?"
Cal asked.
"I don't mean anything," Lula said. "That's one of those things you say when you're trying to be friendly. That's an opening line."
"Oh."
"I heard you hit your head when you fainted in the hospital," Lula said.
"Yeah."
"Are you okay now?"
"Yeah."
"I could be wrong here," Lula said, "but I think you're dumb as a box of rocks."
"Sticks and stones," Cal said.
There was a moment of silence where I figured Lula was regrouping.
"So," Lula finally said to Cal, "are you married?"
The whole packing process took less than 10 minutes. I'd been moving clothes piece by piece to Morelli's house over the last couple days, and there wasn't a lot left. I handed the laundry basket over to Junior, and everyone marched out to the hall and waited while I locked up. I took a last look at the closed door and had to choke back a panic attack. I was turning my apartment over to my sister. I was homeless. What if I had a fight with Morelli? What then? Junior put the laundry basket in the back of the Escape, and we all got into our cars.
"Where are we going?" Lula wanted to know.
"We're going to Tribro. I'm not sure what I'm going to do once I get there. I guess I'll figure it out then." I cut across town and picked up Route 1. It was the middle of the day and traffic was light. Cal had no problem following me. I took the off-ramp that led to the industrial park and wound through the park to Tribro. I parked toward the back of the lot, and I sat there watching. "The killer's in that building," I said to Lula.
"You think it's Bart?"
"I don't know. I just know it has to be someone at Tribro." After a half hour, Lula was restless.
"I gotta get something to eat," she said. "I gotta stretch my legs. I'm all cramped up in this car."
I was hungry, too. I didn't know what I was doing in the lot anyway. Waiting for divine intervention, I supposed. A message from God. A sign. A clue. I put the car in gear and left the lot, with the steroidopods following close behind. I drove down Route 1 for a couple miles, took the turn off to the mall, and parked at the Macy's entrance. This is always a good place to park, because you hit the shoe department first thing while you still have lots of energy. Lula pushed through the double glass doors and stood in the middle of the aisle.
"They're having a sale," she said. "Look at all those racks of shoes on sale."
I looked at the racks, and for the first time in Plum history, I didn't want to shop. My mind wouldn't move off the carnation killer. I was thinking of Lillian Parisi and Fisher Cat and Sing and Howie, and probably there were a lot of others. I knew of 2 games, but there might have been more. I was thinking of my sister's baby and the fact that I didn't have one, and maybe never would.
"Look at those sandals with the 4-inch heels and rhinestones," Lula said. "You can't go wrong with rhinestones, and heels always make your legs look real shapely. I read that in a magazine."
Lula had her shoes off, looking for a pair of the sandals in her size. She was wearing a poison green spandex tube top and yellow stretch pants that matched my car and came to mid-calf. She found the sandals, slipped them on, and paraded in front of the mirror. Cal and Junior were at the edge of the aisle, looking uncomfortable. They probably had expected to follow me around and catch some scofflaws when they got their marching orders from Ranger. And here they were in Macy's shoe department, gaping at Lula, who was all boobs and booty in the rhinestone shoes.
"What do you think?" Lula wanted to know. "Should I get these shoes?"
"Sure," I said. "They'll go with the pink outfit you got in Vegas." What if Ranger's wrong, I thought. What if the carnation killer is tired of the game and doesn't want to play with me? What if he just wants to kill me? He could be watching me now, lining me up in his sights. Lula paid for the shoes and we hit the food court next. Lula got a chicken. I got a cheeseburger. Cal and Junior got nothing. Guess they didn't eat while working. Didn't want to have a burger in their hand if they had to go for their guns. That was fine by me. I was scanning the mall and my eyes were rolling around in my head so fast I was getting a headache. I watched Lula tear into her food,
and I had a creepy thought that she might be right about her teeth. She could really rip apart a chicken.
"What are you staring at?" Lula wanted to know. "Are you staring at my teeth?"
"No, swear to God, I was just daydreaming." After we ate, we went back to the cars. I drove about a half mile down Route 1, and Lula and I turned our attention to the motel coming up on the right. It was the Morelli and Gilman Motel.
"Probably I didn't see what I thought I saw that day," Lula said. "Probably I was just imagining."
Lula stopped talking, because Morelli's truck was parked in front of one of the units.
"Uh-oh," Lula said.
I'd been doing 80, and I was a quarter mile past the hotel by the time I screeched to a stop. Cal and Junior went flying past me, utter surprise and horror on their faces. I put the escape into reverse, backed up on the shoulder at a modest 50 miles per hour, and turned into the motel parking lot. No sign of Cal and Junior.
"Suppose it's police business," Lula wanted to know. "Like maybe it's a sting."
"He's not working Vice anymore. And this isn't even in Trenton."
"You aren't going to do something stupid like beat down the door, are you?"
I parked at the far end of the lot, behind a tan van. "Do you have a better idea?"
"We could sneak around back and listen in. Then, if we hear them doing the deed, we can beat down the door."
I'd rather knock and have Morelli answer the door half-dressed than catch Morelli and Gilman in the act. I couldn't think of too many things that would be more depressing than hearing or seeing Morelli play hide the salami with someone other than me. On the other hand, I didn't want to make a false accusation.
"Okay," I said, "we'll go around back."
We walked around the side of the motel and began counting off units. Each unit had two windows on the back side. I was guessing one window was in the bathroom and one in the bedroom. There were 12 units in the first building. All were at ground level. A strip of grass hugged the back of the building. Beyond the grass was a chunk of overgrown woods filled with refuse. A plastic milk crate. Soda cans. A torn mattress. I had no idea what was on the other side of the wooded area. Curtains were drawn on all the units. We listened briefly at each window, hearing nothing. We got to the 7th unit and heard voices. Lula and I pressed closer to the window. The voices were muted, difficult to hear. The back window was closed. The air conditioner was running in the front window. There was a slight break in the curtain halfway up the back window. Lula tippy-toed to the woods and got the milk crate. She put the milk crate under the window and motioned that I should get on the crate and look in the window. No way was I going to look in the window. I didn't want to see what was going on inside. I whispered to Lula that she should look. Lula got up on the milk crate, pressed her nose to the window, and her phone rang. Lula grabbed at the phone hooked onto her stretch pants and stopped the ringing, but it was too late. Everyone heard the phone. Shouting erupted from inside the motel room. A gunshot rang out, and a large man in a tan suit crashed through the window and knocked Lula off the milk crate.
"What the hell?"
Lula said, sprawled on the ground in a tangle of curtain sprinkled with window glass. I wasn't sure what any of this was about, but I'd heard the shot, and the guy who came through the window wasn't Joe, so I roundhoused him with my purse and sent him to his knees. I had him at gunpoint when Morelli stuck his head out the broken window.
"Oh, Christ," Morelli said when he saw me, and he ducked back inside.
Guys came running from either side of the building. Obviously cops, but I didn't know any of them. Two were in FBI t-shirts. Morelli joined them. I didn't see anything of Terry Gilman. Morelli grabbed me by the arm and pulled me aside.
"What the hell are you doing here?"
"I saw your truck."
"And?"
"I thought I'd stop by to say hello."
"I'm working."
I was getting annoyed. He was just a notch below yelling at me. "How was I to know? This isn't Trenton. You're not driving your crappy cop car. And a couple weeks ago, Lula saw you coming out of this motel with Terry Gilman." Morelli's eyes narrowed.
"You went around back to spy on me and Gilman?"
"Actually, Lula was going to do the spying. I didn't want to look." The guy in the suit was getting dragged away in bracelets. Isn't that Tommy Gallucci? I asked Morelli. Tommy Gallucci was famous in the Berg. Everyone knew he was a mob boss, but the police had never been able to get anything to stick on him. Maybe because in the past, the police never really cared all that much. Being a mob boss in Trenton didn't get you on America's Most Wanted. Trenton was just a mid-sized pothole in the organized crime highway. And Gallucci was a good citizen. He gave to the church. He kept his yard nice. He went out of town to cheat on his wife. But lately, it was rumored Gallucci was having a midlife crisis, wanting to make more of a name for himself, pushing his associates around.
Yes, it's Tommy Gallucci. Some of his business partners aren't happy with him and want to see him removed some way other than a one-way ticket to the landfill. They decided it would be a good thing for everyone if Tommy got to spend a couple years relaxing on a farm.
Like a federal-run farm surrounded by razor wire?
Yeah, something like that. The business partners decided they wanted me to run the operation. Probably that was Uncle Spud's suggestion. And Gilman was acting as the go-between. People see me and Gilman together, and the first thought isn't Sting.
It wasn't my first thought. Why this motel?
It's owned by Gallucci's brother-in-law. Gallucci did a lot of business here. Felt safe to him.
Guess I screwed things up.
I don't know what it is with you. You fall into a hole filled with shit, and you come up smelling like a rose. Gallucci wasn't cooperating. I wasn't getting anywhere with him. When he heard the phone, he freaked, thinking he was set up. He shot the Fed who was in the room with me, and then he tried to escape by going out the window. The Fed in the room with me just got a superficial flesh wound, but now we have Gallucci on assault with a deadly weapon.
I looked beyond Morelli and saw two suits grilling Lula. You better rescue Lula, I said. Probably it's not a good idea to let those guys look in her purse. Morelli did some negotiating with the feds involved in the bust, and it was suggested that Lula and I should leave the scene immediately and never return. Lula and I were happy to comply with the suggestion. Cal and Junior had backtracked and found me and were parked two cars down in the motel lot. Their faces were red, and they had deodorant failure. Ranger wouldn't have been happy if they'd lost me.
See that? Lula said when we were all heading south on Route 1. I told you Morelli was there on account of work. You should be more trusting of Morelli.
If you'd been in my shoes, would you have trusted him?
Hell no, Lula said.
Truth is, I did trust Morelli. But there's a limit to trust. Even the most trusting woman who saw her boyfriend's truck at a motel in the middle of the day twice would have doubts. There's a difference between being trusting and being stupid. Traffic was heavy and slow going in and out of Trenton. It was coming up on rush hour. Drivers looked sweaty and impatient. Men drummed their fingers. Women chewed on their cheeks. I was still feeling the pull from Tribro. I turned off Route 1 and found my place in the Tribro lot.
I don't get it, Lula said. What's with this parking thing? What are you waiting for?
I didn't know. Instinct kept dragging me here today. I half expected to see ominous dark clouds boiling over the building. Ghostbuster clouds. Portents of danger. We sat there for a while, and employees started to leave. The lot was almost empty, and my phone rang. It was Clyde.
Hey, Stephanie Plum, he said. Is that you out in the lot? I see a yellow car, and it looks like you inside. I'm watching you with binoculars. Wave to me.
I waved to Clyde.
What are you doing in the lot?
He wanted to know. Just sitting, I said. Watching.
Is that your partner with you?
Yeah, that's Lula.
It's quitting time, he said. Do you and Lula want to go to dinner? We could all get a burger someplace.
I don't think so.
Okay, Clyde said. Call me if you change your mind.
Pretty soon we're going to be in this lot all by ourselves, Lula said. You and me and the two big dummies over there. You aren't planning on breaking in, are you? Maybe see if Bart Cohn left his computer on?
Bart's smarter than that. He's not going to leave anything incriminating on his computer. Even if he did, I'm not that good at computers to be able to find it. And I'm sure the building has an alarm system. The idea was tempting, though. just not practical. And it was out of my league. It was a ranger escapade.
Okay, then how about the guy who just called you? The goofy comb brother that doesn't do anything and wants to be a junior G-man. He's always wanting to take you out, right? I bet you could get him to let you in. I bet he doesn't even like his brother.
No, I'll never get rid of him. It would be like feeding a stray cat. Once you give it a bowl of food, you're stuck with a cat for life. I don't even talk to Clyde Cone.
Too bad, Lula said, because I bet he'd let you in and you could go snooping through old Bart's files and drawers and everything. You couldn't get into his email, but you could take a look at the desktop on his computer.
Truth is, I didn't want to go into the building, not even with Cal and Junior doing backup. There was something bad in the building. The monster was there. He was waiting for me. I got a call from Morelli wondering where I was. I didn't know what to say. I was sitting in an empty parking lot, waiting for the mystery to be resolved. I'll be home soon, I told him. Don't worry. The don't worry message was insincere. I was worried. I was really, really worried.
Steph, Lula finally said, maybe we should go home.
She was right, of course. So I cranked my yellow Escape over and drove out of the lot. I dropped Lula off at her car at the office, and then I went home to Morelli. I made peanut butter and olive sandwiches for supper, and we ate in silence in front of the television. Probably we should have talked about the motel thing, but neither of us knew how to begin. Maybe it wasn't important anyway. We seemed to still like each other. At 9 o'clock, Morelli was glued to the television, and I was still fighting the fear or dread or whatever the hell it was that had its grip on me. I went to the kitchen and got a beer and took it out to the back porch. The air was soft and smelled nice, like fresh dirt and new grass. Joe didn't do much with his backyard, but his next-door neighbor, Mrs. Lukacs, had flower beds and a dogwood tree. Joe and I had gardening skills that were almost as good as our housekeeping and cooking skills. I finished my beer and stood. I turned toward the house, and I felt a familiar, piercing pain in my back. In my mind, I called for Morelli, but either he didn't hear over the drone of the television, or else it was only a mental plea for help, because the blackness came, and there was no Morelli. Even before I opened my eyes, I knew I was in trouble. Fear filled every part of me. The fear was a hard knot in my chest. The fear clogged my throat. The fear slid in a greasy wave through my stomach. I forced my eyes open, and I looked around. I was on the floor, in the dark. I didn't seem to be hurt. I wasn't restrained. I moved my leg and realized I had a chain padlocked around my ankle. There were jingle bells attached to the chain. The potential significance of the ankle chain took my breath away. I had a dull, throbbing ache behind my eyes. It was from the drug, I thought, like last time when I was shot with a dart in the parking lot. The only source of light was a single candle burning on a desk to my right. The light was dim, but I knew where I was. I was at Tribro. I was in Clyde's office. I could make out the action figures in the bookcase to my left. I pushed myself up so I was sitting and realized someone was slouched in a chair, lost in shadow, watching me from across the room. The shadowed figure leaned forward into the candlelight, and I saw that it was Clyde.
"You're awake," he said, "and you look scared. Sometimes when I get scared, I get sexually excited. Do you get excited when you get scared? Are you hot?"
The words sent a new rush of cold fear into my chest. I looked into Clyde's eyes, and I saw the monster emerging.
"Get up," Clyde said. "Go around the desk and open the drawer. I have a surprise for you."
I steadied myself on the desk and got to my feet, swallowing back nausea from the drug. I inched around the desk, carefully opened the drawer, and looked down at another lock of my hair, tied with a slim pink ribbon. I looked up, and my eyes met Clyde's.
Now you know, Clyde said. You're surprised, right? I bet you never thought it was me.
Everything fell into place. Webmaster wasn't a computer term, as we'd all assumed. It was a Spider-Man reference. Days ago, I asked Clyde what he wanted to do, and he said he wanted to be Spider-Man. Spider-Man was known as the Web-Slinger, and Clyde's game name was the Webmaster. Spider-Man didn't kill innocent people, I said. Spider-Man was a good guy.
I'm not the Web-Slinger, Clyde said. I'm the Webmaster. There's a difference, and I don't kill innocent people. I run a game so people can kill each other. How cool is that?
What about the prey? Aren't they innocent?
I pick the prey out real careful, and they're never innocent. The cop killed a guy in the line of duty, and so have you. As soon as I saw you at the plant that day, I knew you had to be the next prize. Bart tried to warn you away, but you wouldn't listen. It wouldn't have mattered. I had my mind made up right away.
Bart knows about the game? Clyde was smiling, rocking back on his heels, enjoying his moment.
Bart's confused. I got careless with the game 2 years ago, and Bart got to read an email. Parisi and Fisher Cat were left in the game, and I was giving them the kill clue. Bart didn't know it was a game. He thought I was involved with Parisi, and he went to the kill spot to stop me from a crime of passion. Problem was, he got there too late. Parisi was dead, and Fisher Cat was gone.
And Bart was accused of the crime.
Yeah, and he was being a hero, protecting me. What a moron. Then when the DNA came back, he was totally confused. It wasn't his DNA, of course. And Bart knows enough science to know that the DNA couldn't have been mine, either. It had the wrong structure. It was Fisher Cat's DNA.
Didn't Bart ask you about the email?
Yeah. I gave him some bullshit story about unrequited love. And he wanted to believe it. He wasn't warning you off because of the game. He was worried I'd go gonzo for you and write another nutcase letter.
What about Andrew? Did Andrew know about the game?
Andrew? You gotta be kidding. Andrew's got his perfect office and his perfect family and his freaking perfect house. Andrew doesn't see bad things, doesn't allow them into his life, doesn't ask questions that might have troubling answers. Andrew lives in denial land. Everyone always thinks Andrew's so perfect, and everyone always underestimates me. Silly, lazy Clyde. Poor, dumb Clyde.
And?
I'm not dumb. I'm smarter than everybody. Ask any of the people who play my game.
They're all dead, I said.
Oh, yeah, Clyde said on a giggle. I forgot.
Why did Singh take off?
He was scared. He went after Bagman, who you know as Howie. Somehow Singh managed to screw up the kill, and then his cover was blown. He turned chicken and ran.
Now what?
Now we play. I've got a new game I thought up just for you. It's sort of a treasure hunt, and the grand prize is death. It's going to be a real good death, too. Scary and sexy and bloody.
This guy was so crazy. He'd been letting the insanity leak out little by little over the years, and no one had noticed. Or maybe his family had noticed, and chose not to recognize it for what it was.
Okay, here we go, Clyde said. I'm going to tell you about the game.
Morelli would have discovered I was gone by now. He'd call Ranger, and they'd be out looking for me. If I dragged this on long enough, they might find me in time. I can't think, I said. I have a headache and nausea from the drug.
That should be passing. I gave you a small dose, just enough to have you unconscious for the capture. Probably what you're experiencing is a blood pressure rise from the fear. You're scared, right?
I looked at Clyde. I didn't say anything.
Yeah, Clyde said. You're scared big time. I can feel it. I'm very sensitive to these things.
I raised an eyebrow.
I am, Clyde said. I have heightened senses like a superhero or a werewolf.
I understand pigs have a superior sense of smell. Maybe you're part pig. I was relieved not to have stuttered. I was so scared my mouth felt detached from my face.
"Here's the game plan," Clyde said. "All the doors are locked. You can't get out. Your only hope is to find a weapon and eliminate me before I get tired of playing with you. I have a loaded gun, a stun gun, and a big sharp knife hidden somewhere in the plant. Plus, there are things you'd naturally find here, like acid and hammers and shit like that. I've got two of your buddies hanging out here, waiting for you to find them. If you die, they die too. In fact, if you don't find them soon enough, they'll die. You have a half hour to find the first one."
"Who are they?"
"That's for you to discover. Oh yeah, and I forgot to tell you, you'll be doing this in the dark. You can take the candle if you want. Romantic, right?"
He was smiling again. I guess this was his idea of a date.
"I've disconnected the alarm system," he said. "If you trip the smoke detectors, the signal won't get sent out anywhere. The sprinklers will go off and we'll all get wet, but nobody will come to save you. That might be fun, seeing you in a wet t-shirt."
Clyde stood so I could see he was armed.
"I have a .22 for the kill," he said. "And I have a paintball gun and a pellet gun for the rabbit in the shooting gallery. That's you. You're the rabbit." "Oh, yeah. And I have a taser. It's new. I always wanted to use a taser."
He pointed the taser at me.
"This is the start of playtime. I'm going to give you a chance to run. I'm going to count to 20, and then I'm going to shoot you with the taser. Go!"
He started counting, and I took off, forgetting the candle. Halfway down the hall, I had to stop running. It was pitch black, and I had no idea what was in front of me. I put my hand to the wall, feeling my way, jingling with every step. The hall led to the front foyer, and I was prepared to crash through the glass door if necessary. I needed to get out of the building. Crazy Clyde was going to kill me, and he wasn't going to spare his hostages. It didn't matter who I found. We were all going to die unless I could escape and get help. Clyde wasn't going to leave witnesses. I saw the ambient light from the foyer and broke into a run. I turned the corner, heard gunshot, and felt the sting of impact. I felt blood run down my side, down my leg. I cried out and put my hand to my side. Paint. I was hit with a paintball.
"I'm right behind you," Clyde said. "If you go toward the door, I'll shoot you with a taser. I'm dying to use the taser. Sometimes they use these things for torture. The electric lead stays hooked into you with a barb, and you can keep getting shocked. How cool is that?"
I was in the middle of the floor, and I was breathing heavy.
"What do you want me to do?"
"I want you to run, Rabbit. Run away from the door."
I took a step and stumbled down to one knee. I was too scared to run, too scared to think. Not good, I told myself. I had to try to stay calm. I managed to get myself to my feet, and I ran in blind panic down the other side of the hall, toward Andrew's and Bart's offices. There was a faint bar of light under a door jamb in front of me. I pushed the door, and it swung open. It was Bart's office. The office was lit by a single candle on the desk. Albert Clown was duct-taped to the desk chair behind the desk. He had duct tape across his mouth and wrapped around his ankles. His eyes were huge, and tears rolled down his cheeks. I ripped the tape off his mouth and was about to go for the tape around his torso when I saw the bomb.
"Don't touch me," he said. "I'm booby-trapped."
I snatched at the desk phone. No dial tone. I locked the door from the inside and pawed through the junk on Bart's desk, looking for something helpful. My hands were shaking, and my heart was thundering in my chest.
"I hate this," I said. "I hate this game, and I hate the pathetic excuse for a human being who's out there stalking me."
"You have to get help," Clown said. "This guy is crazy. He's gonna kill us."
"There are just nuts and bolts on this desk," I said. "I need something I can use as a weapon."
"I know where there's a weapon," Clown said. "I can swivel myself in this chair, and I was looking out the window into the warehouse when the crazy guy was hiding things. There's a room off to the side with glass windows all along."
"The quality control area?"
"I don't know, but there's a workstation just by the door to that room, and he hid a gun there. It's right on the top of the table part of the machine."
There was a knock on the door.
You're not allowed to lock yourself in Bart's office, Clyde said. It doesn't matter anyway. I've got a key. But now you're going to have to get punished before we can go on with the playtime.
I heard the key scrape in the lock, and I grabbed a wooden crate half filled with gears and threw it at the window that led to the warehouse. The glass shattered, and I dove through the window. If I got cut, it wasn't going to be any worse than what was going to happen to me at Clyde's hands. I hit the ground and rolled. I'd seen the roll done in the movies, and it seemed like a good idea. Problem was, in the movies they weren't usually landing on 2,000 metal gears. Still, I wasn't decapitated from the glass shards when I pitched myself through the broken window, so that was a point in my favor. I scrambled to my feet, sliding on the debris, and ran for the first workstation. Beyond the first workstation, the room blacked out, and I was going to have to feel my way to the side room where the quality control people worked. I was almost to the workstation when I was hit by another paintball. Thank God I must have been beyond the reach of the taser. The paintball hit square in my upper back. If I lived to see another day, I'd be bruised. I dropped to the floor and put the workstation between me and Clyde. I heard Clown give an unearthly, blood-curdling shriek. The candlelight went out, and then everything was quiet. I was guessing that Clyde didn't want a chance going through the broken window. He was going to have to go back to the hall and enter the warehouse through the door at the end of the adjoining corridor. That gave me some time. I crossed the room as fast as I could, creeping along low to the ground, my hands outstretched to keep from smashing into a workstation. I found the wall with the windows and knew I was in the right place. I followed the wall to the door and then paced off to the workstation. Sure enough, there was the gun, just like Clown said. I couldn't see the gun even when I held it inches from my face, but I could feel that it was a six-shot revolver, and it was loaded. I backed myself into the test room and closed the door. I took up a position behind a desk, kneeling with my forearms resting on the desk, two-handing the gun to keep it from shaking. I was doing deep, controlled breaths, telling myself to focus, to be a professional. I heard the door open, and I shouted for Clyde to stop. There was a gunshot, and I felt a hit to my shoulder. And in that instant, I unloaded everything I had. I squeezed off all six rounds, shooting blind. The last shot was followed by silence. It was solid black in the office. I couldn't see my hand in front of my face. Either Clyde was dead, or else he'd retreated. I wasn't willing to leave the desk to find out. It was Dolly Friedman's desk. I reached into her top drawer and got her pepper spray. Then I ducked under the desk and waited. I heard something scuff in the direction of the door, and my heart stuttered. He wasn't dead. The monster wasn't dead. A sob caught in my throat, and I blinked back tears. There was the rustle of clothing directly in front of me, and I covered my face with my arm and hit the trigger on the pepper spray. "Oh, shit! Fuck!" a man's voice, not Clyde. The spray was knocked out of my grasp. A hand grabbed me by the front of my shirt, hauled me out from under the desk, and dragged me to my feet, moving me out of the area, away from the spray. I was told to hold still. I knew this voice. I was held tight to Ranger. He slid goggles over my head, and I was able to see in the dark. Ranger had two men with him, Cal and Junior, and Junior was bent at the waist, gagging. That was the one I got with the spray. "Sorry," I said. He made a dismissive gesture with his hand. I looked to the door and saw feet. Clyde's. The feet weren't moving. Clyde hadn't jumped away fast enough. Turned out Clyde wasn't as smart as he thought. "Dead?" I asked.
"Looks that way. From what I can see, he took three in the upper body."
"I was shooting blind in the dark," I said. "I didn't know if I hit him."
"Anyone else in the building?"
"He has Albert Clown tied up with a bomb strapped to his chest in one of the offices. He said he had another hostage. I don't know who that is. I didn't find the other hostage."
My knees gave out, and I sort of sunk into Ranger and dissolved into tears.
He had his arms tight around me, holding me to him. He sent Junior in search of the mechanical room to get the lights back on. He sent Cal to search for the second hostage. Then he called Morelli.
"I've got Stephanie," Ranger said. "She's safe, but there's a hostage unfound and a hostage potentially carrying a bomb. I haven't seen the bomb. I'm going to check it out now."
"Where's Joe?"
I asked, wiping my nose with the back of my hand, trying to regain some control.
"We split up. I got the factory, and he went to Clyde's house."
"How did you know it was Clyde?"
"Cal saw the truck there past him. He didn't know what the truck driver was up to, but he thought it was suspicious enough to check with Morelli. Cal got part of the plate, and Morelli ran it through the system, checking it against the principles."
The lights flickered, and we took our goggles off. Every light flashed on at full power, and we got a better look at Clyde. He was lying face up. The monster was gone, and Clyde looked very ordinary in death. In fact, he looked oddly peaceful. Maybe it had been a relief to give up the game.
"Help,"
Albert Clown said. His voice was barely a whisper. We all turned and stared at him, strapped to his chair on the other side of the warehouse. His face was red and mottled, and he looked like he wasn't going to live long enough for the bomb to explode. Ranger jogged across the room.
"Try not to move," Ranger said to Clown. "I'm coming around to take a closer look."
We all followed after Ranger, watching from the hall while Ranger went into the office.
"I think it's a dummy," Ranger said, "but I'm not an expert."
He took out a pocket knife and cut the duct tape away from Clown's ankles. He sliced into the tape binding Clown to the chair.
"I'm not going to touch the device you've got strapped to your chest," Ranger said. "Stay here in the chair until the police get here with a demolition team."
Ranger's walkie-talkie chirped. It was Cal.
"You have to see this," he said. "I think I found the second hostage. I'm in the lunchroom."
We left Junior with Clown, and we followed the hall to the lunchroom. Cal was standing, hands on hips, smiling up at Lula. She was swinging like a giant piñata from a rope attached to a ceiling fan. She was still wearing the poison green top and the yellow stretch pants, and her feet were treading air about 15 feet off the ground. Her arms were duct-taped to her sides, and she had duct-tape across her mouth. A thick rope was wrapped around and threaded through the duct tape on her body, and then looped around the fan. She had the beady little charging bull eyes. She was making angry mm-mm sounds under the duct tape, and she was kicking her feet. Plaster dust was sifting down on her head from the ceiling fixture. Ranger's face creased into a smile.
"I love my job," he said.
"He must have gotten her up there with a forklift," Cal said. "There's one parked down the hall. Do you want me to drive it down here?"
"Don't need it,"
Ranger said, shoving a table under Lula, climbing onto the table. Her feet were still swinging in the air, and she was still kicking.
"You kick me, and I'm leaving you here," Ranger said.
"Hmm,"
Lula said under the duct tape. Ranger worked at the rope with his knife. The rope gave, and Lula dropped onto the table. Cal reached out to support her, and the two of them went to the floor. I ripped the tape off Lula's mouth, and Ranger cut the tape that was binding her arms.
"I was drugged," Lula said. "Do you believe it? I was taking the garbage out, and he shot me in the ass with a dart. That little shit, Clyde. Next thing I know, I'm swinging around from the ceiling. I'm beside myself. I'm in a state. I didn't know what to think. I saw some kinky shit when I was a hoe, but I never did anything like this."
She looked around, wild-eyed.
"I need something to eat. This here's an eating situation."
She spied the vending machine and stormed across the room.
"I need money. I need quarters or dollars or something. Oh, my God, they got Twinkies in here. I need a Twinkie real bad."
"What about the supermodel diet?" I asked Lula.
"Fuck that. I hate those bony-ass supermodels anyway. I don't know what I was thinking."
Lula was shaking the vending machine.
"Who's got a hammer?" she asked. "Somebody help me out here."
Ranger slid a dollar into the machine, and Lula punched the button.
"Hello, Twinkie," she said. "I'm coming home. Lula's back in town."
It was way after midnight when Morelli and I got back to his house. Morelli dragged me up the stairs, stripped my clothes off, and shoved me into the shower. I had paint everywhere. Yellow, red, blue.
"You're a disaster," Morelli said, standing to one side, watching me.
"Is it coming out of my hair?"
"It's out of your hair, but I think you might have a permanent blue stain down the back of your neck." "You're not going to believe this," Morelli said, "but I'm too tired for sex. I'm beat. I'm not even 40, and you've turned me into a burnout. I'm standing here looking at you naked in the shower, and nothing's happening."
The soap slid from my fingers. I bent to retrieve it, and Morelli changed his mind on the burnout.
"Move over," Morelli said, peeling his clothes off. "I can see you need help here."
I woke up feeling great. I opened my eyes, and I knew it was over. No more red roses and white carnations. The sun was shining, birds were chirping. Albert Clown didn't explode with the bomb. Morelli was beside me, still sleeping. Life was good. Okay, so I was slightly homeless, and I had a blue stain down the back of my neck. Ranger was still at large, waiting to get even for the Apusenja event, but that was in the future. It could be worse. Eventually, I'd get my apartment back. And in the meantime, I was with Morelli. Who knows? Maybe I'll just stay here. Then again. The doorbell rang. I propped myself up on an elbow and looked at the bedside clock. 8:30. Joe put his hands to his face and groaned.
"Was that the doorbell?"
I got out of bed and went to the window. Joe's mother and Grandmother Bella were on the front porch. They looked up at me and smiled. "Shit." "It's your mom and Bella," I said. "You'd better go see what they want."
"I can't go," Joe said. "My mother would fall off the porch if she saw me like this."
I looked under the sheet. He was right. His mother would fall off the porch. "Fine," I said, rolling my eyes. "I'll go. But you better throw some cold water on yourself and come down and rescue me." I wrapped a robe around myself and ran a hand through my hair on the way down the stairs. I opened the door and tried my best to smile, but my mouth only partly cooperated.
"Coffee cake," Joe's mother said, handing me the bakery bag. "Fresh made today, and Bella has something to tell you."
Joe's mother elbowed Bella.
"It's about the vision," Bella said. "I was wrong about the dead blonde wife and the babies. It wasn't Joseph in the vision. It was Bobby Bartolucci."
"That's a relief," I said. "But poor Mrs. Bartolucci."
"I could have been wrong about the dead part, too," Bella said. "Maybe she was just sleeping."
I heard Morelli on the stairs behind me, felt his hand rest on my shoulder.
"Morning,"
he said to his mother and grandmother.
"And one more thing," Bella said to me. "It's about your car. It's gonna be blown up. Kaboom! There's gonna be nothing left of it. But don't worry, you won't be in it. I had a vision."
Bella and Joe's mom drove away, and Joe and I stood in the open doorway, staring at my car.
"Something to look forward to," Joe said.
And then he kissed me and took the bakery bag into the kitchen. This is Lorelei King. We hope you have enjoyed To the Nines, a Renaissance audiobook from St. Martin's Press. To the Nines was produced by Laura Wilson and directed by Tamsin Collison. Text copyright 2003 by Ivanovich Inc. Production copyright 2003, Audio Renaissance, a division of Holdspring Publishers, LLC. All rights reserved.